Chapter 2, Emotion. Fear. What brings freedom from fear, and I assure you the freedom is complete, is to be aware of fear without the word, without trying to deny or escape from fear, without wanting to be in some other state. If with complete attention you are aware of the fact that there is fear, then you will find that the observer and the observed are one. There is no division between them. There is no observer who says, "I am afraid." There is only fear without the word, which indicates that state. The mind is no longer escaping, no longer seeking to get rid of fear, no longer trying to find the cause, and therefore it is no longer a slave to words. There is only a movement of learning, which is the outcome of innocence, and an innocent mind has no fear. Have you any kind of fear, physical or psychological? If one has psychological fears, how do you deal with them? If I am afraid that I shall lose my position, my prestige, I depend on the audience, on you, to bolster me up. I depend on you to give me vitality by talking. And I am afraid if I grow older, become senile, I will be faced with nothing. And I am afraid. Or I am afraid that I depend on you. Dependency makes me attached to you. And I am afraid to lose you. I am afraid I have done something in the past which I regret or I am ashamed of, and I don't want you to know. So I am afraid of that, of your knowing it, and I feel guilty. Or I feel terribly anxious about death, living, what people say, what people don't say, how they look at me, the deep sense of foreboding, anxiety, a sense of inferiority, living a life that has no meaning. Out of my anxiety, I seek some assurance from somebody in human relationship, or I seek a sense of security in a certain belief, in an ideology, in God, and so on. And also I am afraid that I shan't be able to do everything I want to do in this life. I haven't the capacity or the intelligence, but I am tremendously ambitious to achieve something. And so I am frightened of that, too. And, of course, I am afraid of death. And I am afraid of being lonely, not being loved. And so I want to establish a relationship with another in which this fear doesn't exist, this anxiety, this sense of loneliness, this separation. And also I am afraid of the dark, the innumerable neurotic fears that one has. Now, what is this fear? Why is there this fear? Is it based on not being hurt, not to be hurt? Or is it that one wants complete security, and not being able to find it physically, emotionally, psychologically, intellectually, not being able to find this sense of complete safety, security, protection, one becomes terribly anxious about living. One of our major problems is fear, whether we are aware of it or not, whether we run away from it or try to overcome it, try to withstand it, develop courage, and so on, there is still fear. Is the mind so delicate, so sensitive, that it doesn't want to be hurt from childhood on? And so, not wanting to be hurt, one builds a wall. One is very shy or aggressive. Before you attack, I am ready to attack you, verbally, with thought, because I am so sensitive. I have been hurt so much in my life, in my childhood. In the office, in the factory, everybody treads on each other's toes, and I don't want to be hurt. Is that one of the reasons why fear exists? You have been hurt, haven't you? And out of that hurt, we do all kinds of things. We resist a great deal. We don't want to be disturbed. Out of that feeling of hurt, we cling to something that we hope will protect us, and therefore I become aggressive towards anything that attacks that which I am holding onto as protection. What is it that you as a human being are frightened of? Is it a physical fear? Fear not to have any more physical pain? Or a psychological fear of danger, of uncertainty, of being further hurt, of not being able to find total, complete security, certainty, fear of not wanting to be dominated? And yet we are dominated. So what is it that you as a human being are frightened of? Are you aware of your fear? Fear, pleasure, and sorrow have existed from time beyond thought. Man has always had these three factors in life: fear, the pursuit of pleasure, and sorrow. And apparently, man has not gone beyond that. We have tried every method, every system that you can think of. We have tried to suppress it, tried to escape from it, tried to invent a god, and surrender all to that invention. But that has not worked either. So we must find out whether sorrow can end, and understand the nature of sorrow, the cause of sorrow. Is the cause different from fear? Is the cause different from pleasure? Pleasure of achievement, pleasure of possession, pleasure of having great power, pleasure of talent, pleasure of wealth. So let us find out whether sorrow and fear can ever end. The pursuit of pleasure is infinite, endless, not only of sexual pleasure, but also the pleasure of becoming something, the pleasure of achievement, the pleasure of being attached to somebody, whether that attachment is to a person, to an idea, or to a conclusion. And while you are pursuing that pleasure, there is always the shadow of fear with it. And where there is fear, there is sorrow. Fear is not separate. They are all together. They are all interrelated, and one must deal with them all wholly, not separately. You must approach this whole thing wholly, not fragmentarily. If you approach it fragmentarily, you will never solve it. Greed, pain, sorrow is a movement of life, a whole movement of life, not something different from life. This is our daily life. And to find out whether there is an end to all this, to misery, to conflict, pain, sorrow, and fear, one must be able to perceive them. One must be able to be aware of them. So we must understand what perception is, how to look at all this. Is the poverty, the loneliness, the anxiety, the uncertainty, the suffering different from the observer? Or is all that the observer? We have separated the me, who is the observer, from that which he is observing. I say, I am suffering, and I say to myself that suffering must end, and to end it, I must suppress it, I must escape from it, I must follow a certain system. So I am different from fear, from pleasure, from pain, sorrow. Are you different from all that? You may think that there is something in you which is totally different from all that, but if you think that, that is part of your thought, and therefore there is nothing sacred there. Is the observer different from the observed? Don't make it absurd. You see a tree, and when you say, "Am I different from the tree?" you are, I hope. But when you are angry, envious, brutal, violent, are you not all that? See the importance of this? We have divided the observer from the observed. That means there is a division between that and the other. So there is conflict. You control it, suppress it, fight it. But if you are that, if you are sorrow, if you are fear, if you are pleasure, you are this whole conglomeration. And to realize that fact is a tremendous reality. Therefore, there is no division, and therefore there is no conflict. Then the observer is the observed. Then a totally different action takes place. A totally different chemical action takes place. It is not an intellectual achievement to see the truth of it, not the intellectual concept of the truth, but the fact that you are not different from your qualities. You are not different from your anger, jealousy, hatred. You are all that. You know what happens when you realize that, not verbally, but inwardly? Find out. I won't tell you. You see how your mind works? You are waiting for me to tell you. You don't want to find out. If I tell you, then you will say, yes, right or wrong, but you will go on. But find out for yourself the actual truth of it, that the observer is the observed, the watcher is the watched. When you watch the full moon, that moon is not you, unless you are loony, but you are the whole bundle of your consciousness. The content of your consciousness is what you are, and the content of that consciousness is put together by thought. Now, find out, not the ending of thought, but how to observe the content. When you observe without the division, then a totally different action takes place. Where there is love, there is no observer. There is no you and the one that you love. There is only that quality of love. Questioner, if, as you say, fear and pleasure are related, can one remove fear and so enjoy pleasure completely? Krishnamurti, lovely, wouldn't it be? Take away all my fears so that I can enjoy myself in my pleasures. Everybody right through the world wants the same thing, some very crudely, some very subtly, to escape fear and hold on to pleasure. Pleasure. You smoke. It is a pleasure, yet there is pain within it because you may get a disease. You have had pleasure, whether as man or woman, sexually or otherwise, comfort and so on. When the other looks away, you are jealous, angry, frustrated, mutilated. Pleasure inevitably brings pain. We are not saying we cannot have pleasure, but see the whole structure, and you will know then that joy, real enjoyment, the beauty of enjoyment, the freedom of it, has nothing whatsoever to do with pleasure, or, therefore, with pain or fear. If you see that, the truth of it, then you will understand pleasure and give it its proper place. Q. Aren't there some fears that are useful, at least for survival? For example, I'm very much afraid of jumping from the Empire State Building. K. Surely, when physically you face a danger, the natural response is self-protection. Physical survival. Is that fear, or is it intelligence? Now, we don't apply that same intelligence with regard to fear, the inward fears, the psychological fears. Look at this, sir, very simply. The world has divided itself into nationalities and religious groups and political groups. This division is bringing about war, hatred. And that very war is destroying us, though we think through nationalism we shall have security. When one realizes all this, intelligence becomes extraordinarily important, and you know when that intelligence is operating, and it can operate only when there is no fear. Mary Zimbalist. Sir, there is a subject you have talked about so many, many times, but it keeps coming back and back in people's questions and preoccupations. and that is the subject of fear. Do you want to talk about that? K. It is a rather complicated subject. It really requires a great deal of inquiry, because it is so subtle, so varied, and so abstract. And also it is actual, too, though we make it into an abstraction. The actuality of fear and the idea of fear, which is the abstraction of fear into an idea. So we must be very clear what we are talking about. The abstraction as an idea of fear, or the actuality of fear. You and I sitting, and all of us sitting here, at this present moment, we are not afraid. There is no sense of apprehension or danger. At this instant, there is no fear. So fear is both an abstraction, as an idea, as a word, and also a fact. First of all, let's deal with these two. Why do we generally make an abstraction of things? Why do we see something actual and then turn it into an idea? Is it because the idea is easier to pursue, or the ideal is our conditioning? Or we are educated to ideas, or in ideas, not educated to deal with facts. Why is this? Why is it that human beings throughout the world deal with abstractions? What should be, what must be, what will happen, and so on. The whole world of ideation and the ideologies, whether it be the communist ideology based on Marx and Lenin, or the capitalists' ideas of so-called free enterprise, and so on, or the whole world of religious concepts, beliefs, ideas, and the theologians working these ideas out. Why is it that ideas, ideals, have become so extraordinarily important? From the ancient Greeks, even before the Greeks and so on, ideas prevailed. And even now, ideas, ideals, separate man and they bring wars, all kinds. Why do the brains of human beings operate this way? Is it because they cannot deal with facts directly, and so escape subtly into ideations? If one sees ideas are really very divisive factors, they bring friction, they divide communities, nations, sects, religions, and so on, which is ideas, beliefs, faith, all that is based on thought. And facts, what are facts? What exactly is a fact, not an opinion about a fact, or opinion made into facts? MZ. What is the fact of fear, sir? K. I am coming to that. First, we must establish the distinction between the idea of fear, the abstraction as the word fear, and the actual fear. The actual fear is the fact, not the abstraction of it. If one can move away from the abstraction, then we can deal with fact. But if they are both running parallel all the time, then there is a conflict between the two. That is, the idea, the ideology dominating the fact, and the fact sometimes dominating the idea. MZ. Most people would say that the fact of fear is a very painful emotion. K. So let us look at the fact. That is what I am coming to. The fact of actual fear, and remain with that fact, which requires a great deal of inward discipline. MZ. Can you describe what remaining with the fact of fear actually is? K. It is like holding a jewel, an intricate pattern, by an artist who has brought this extraordinary jewel. You look at it. You don't condemn it. You don't say, "How beautiful," and run away with words. But you are looking at this extraordinary thing put together by hand, by cunning fingers, and the brain that has brought this. You are watching it. You are looking at it, turn it around, look at the various sides, the back and the front and the side, and you never let it go. MZ: Do you mean that you just feel it very acutely, very sensitively, with great care? K: With care. That is what happens. MZ: But you feel it because it is an emotion. K: Of course. You have the feeling of beauty, the feeling of the intricate pattern, and the sparkle, the brightness, and the sparkle of the jewels, and so on. So can we deal with the fact of fear and look at it that way, not escape, not say, well, I don't like fear, get nervous, apprehensive, and suppress it, or control it, or deny it, or move it into another field? If we can do all that, just remain with that fear, fear then becomes an actual fact, which is there, whether you are conscious of it or not, whether you have hidden it very, very deeply, it is still there. Then we can ask very carefully and hesitantly, what is this fear? Why do human beings, after this tremendous evolution, still live with fear? Is it something that can be operated upon and removed, like a disease, like cancer, or any other dreadful, painful disease? Is it something that can be operated upon, which means there is an entity who can operate upon it? But that very entity is an abstraction of trying to do something about fear. That entity is unreal. What is factual is fear. This requires very careful attention, not to be caught in this abstraction of the one who says, I am observing fear, or one who says, I must put away fear or control fear, and so on. The one who watches is also the outcome of fear. If this is clear, that the observer, to go back to our old saying, the observer is the observed, the thinker is the thought, the doer is the entity who is doing, there is no division. And so, if there is no division, which is an extraordinary fact to realize, a fact, not an idea, I must realize, it is an extraordinary fact that there is no division between the observer and the observed. Therefore, there is no conflict. Conflict exists when there is the observer different from the observed, which is what most of us do, and therefore live with perpetual conflict. That is another matter. So, can we look at fear, and in the very act of looking, watching, begin to discover the origin of fear, the beginning of it, the cause of it? Because the very act of looking at it is to see how it came about. Not that we analyze fear, because the analyzer is the analyzed. Not that we dissect fear, but very close. Delicate watching reveals the content of fear, the content being the origin, the beginning, the causation. Where there is a cause, there is an end. The cause can never be different from the result. In the observation, in the watching, the causation is revealed. MZ: Sir, the causation that you are speaking of is presumably not an individual fear, a particular fear. You are speaking of the causation of fear itself. K: Fear itself, not the various forms of fear. See how we break up fear? That's part of our tradition, to bring about a fragmentation of fear. Therefore, be concerned only with one type of fear, not the whole tree of fear, not a particular branch or a particular leaf of fear, but the whole nature, the structure, the quality of fear. And in observing that very closely, watching it, in the very watching, there is the revelation of the causation. Not you analyze to find out the cause, but the very watching is showing the causation, which is time and thought. Of course, that is simple when you put it that way. Everybody would accept it is time and thought. If there were no time and thought, there would be no fear. MZ. Well, could you enlarge a little bit on that? Because most people think that there is something, that there is, how can I put it? They don't see that there is no future. They think, I am afraid now from a cause. They don't see the factor of time involved. K. I think it is fairly simple. If there were no time, or if there was no saying, I am afraid because I have done something in the past, or I have had pain in the past, or somebody has hurt me, and I don't want to be hurt anymore, all that is the past, the background, which is time. And the future, that is, I am this now, I will die, or I might lose my job, or my wife will be angry with me, and so on. There is this past and the future, and we are caught in between the two. That is, the past has its relationship with the future. The future is not something separate from the past. It is a movement of modification from the past to the future to tomorrow. That is time, this movement of the past, which is the past as I have been, and the future I will be, which is this constant becoming. And that, too, is another complex problem, which we won't touch for the moment. That may be the causation of fear, the becoming. So time is a factor, is a basic factor of fear. There is no question about it. I have a job now. I have money now. I have a shelter over my head. But tomorrow, or many hundred tomorrows, might deprive me of all that. Some accident, some fire, some lack of insurance, and so on. All that is a time factor, not the ending of time. But see, the factor that fear is part of time. Not say, can I end time? That is a silly question. Sorry to use the word silly. Also, thought is a factor of fear. Thought. I have been, I am, but I may not be. The factor of thought, which is limited, which is another matter. Thought is limited because it is based on knowledge. Knowledge is always accumulative, and that which is being added to is always limited. So knowledge is limited. So thought is limited, because thought is based on knowledge, memory, and so on. Thought and time are the central factors of fear. Thought is not separate from time. They are one. They are not divorced. They are not separate. These are the facts. This is the causation of fear. Now, that is a fact, not an idea, not an abstraction. That thought and time is the cause of fear, not are. It is singular. So a man then asks, how do I stop time and thought? Because his intention, his desire, his longing is to be free from fear. And so he is caught in his own desire to be free. But he is not watching the causation very carefully. Watching implies a state of the brain in which there is no movement. It is like watching a bird, and if you watch the bird very closely, as we watched this morning that dove on the windowsill, you watch all the feathers, the red eyes, the sparkle in the eyes, the beak, the shape of its head, the wings. You watch very carefully. And that which you watch very carefully reveals not only the causation, but the ending of the thing you are watching. This watching is really most extraordinarily important. We may ask how to end thought, or how to be free from fear, or what time means, and all the complications of that. But when we are watching fear without any abstraction, it is the actual now, because the now contains all time. The present holds the past, the future, and the present. In that quality of the now, can we listen very carefully, not only with the hearing of the ear, but listen to the word and go beyond the word to see the actual nature of fear. You are then not reading about fear. In watching, it becomes extraordinarily beautiful, sensitive, alive. All this requires an extraordinary quality of attention, because in attention there is no activity of the self. The self-interest in our life is the cause of fear. This sense of me and my concern, my happiness, my success, my failure, my achievement, I am this, I am not, this whole self-centered observation, with all its expressions of fear, agonies, depression, pain, anxiety, aspiration, and sorrow, all that is self-interest, whether in the name of God, in the name of prayer, in the name of faith, it is self-interest. Where there is self-interest, there must be fear, and all the consequences of fear. Then one asks again, is it possible to live in this world where self-interest is predominant, whether it is in the totalitarian world with its search for power and holding power, or the capitalist world with its own power, self-interest is dominant. Whether it is in the religious, hierarchical Catholic world, or in every religious world, self-interest is dominant, and therefore they are perpetuating fear, though they talk about living with pacem in terris, which is peace on earth. They really don't mean it, because self-interest, with the desire for power, position, for its fulfillment, and so on, is the factor that is destroying not only the world, but destroying our own extraordinary capacity of the brain. The brain has extraordinary capacity, as is shown in the technological world, the extraordinary things they are doing. And we never apply that same immense capacity inwardly to be free of fear, to end sorrow, to know what love is, and compassion with its intelligence. We never search, explore that field. We are caught by the world with all its misery. Now, what is fear? We are not dealing with ideas, with words. We are dealing with life, with the things which are happening inside and outside, which needs a very clear, sharp mind, a precise mind. You cannot be sentimental, emotional about all these things. To understand fear, you need clarity. Clarity not of something that you will get, but the clarity that comes when you understand that the fact is infinitely more important than any idea. So, what is fear? Not fear of something. Is there such a thing as fear per se in itself? Or is fear always related to something? And is there fear? I will take death for the moment. You can supply your own example. Is there fear if there is no thought? That is, if there is no time. Most people are afraid of death. However much they might have rationalized it, whatever their beliefs may be, there is the fear of death. That fear is caused by time, not by death, but by time. Time being the interval between now and what is going to happen, which is the process of thinking, which brings about the fear of the unknown. Is it the fear of the unknown or the fear of leaving the things that we know. We are afraid of death. We are not talking of death or what happens after death. We are talking of fear in relation to death. I say, is that fear caused by the thing which I do not know? Obviously, I do not know about death. I can know about it, but that is not the point now. I can investigate, discover the whole beauty, or the ugliness, or the terror, the extraordinary state death must be. Is the fear in relation to death caused by death, which means facing the unknown, or is it caused by the things which I know are going to be taken away from me? The fear is of the things taken away from me, the me disappearing into oblivion. And so I began to protect myself with all the things that I know and live in them more strongly, cling to them much more, than become aware of the unknown. What is it I am afraid of? Not facing the unknown, but facing something which may happen to me when I am taken away from all the things that are held dear, which are close to me. That is what I am afraid of, not of death. What is it that I have, factually, not theoretically? I do not know if you have ever asked yourself a fundamental question to find out what you are. Have you ever asked it, and have you found an answer? Is there an answer? If there is an answer, it is not in terms of what you already know, but what you know is the past, and the past is time, and the time is not you. The you is changing. The thing that is alive never engenders fear. It is the thing that is past, or the thing that should be, that breeds fear. We are caught in words. Why has the word become important and not the thing? Because you can play with ideas. You cannot play with the fact. We are slaves to words. So in understanding fear, there must be an awareness of the word and all the content of the word, which means the mind has to be free of words. To be free of the word is an extraordinary state. Being aware of the symbol, the word, the name, is awareness of the fact at a different dimension, if I can use that word. Now, I am aware of the fact of fear through the word, and I know why the word comes into being. It is an escape. It is tradition. It is the background in which I have been brought up, to deny fear and to develop courage, the opposite, and all the rest of it. And when I understand the whole implication of the word, then there is an awareness of the fact, which is entirely different. You know, what this world needs is not politicians or more engineers, but free human beings. Engineers and scientists may be necessary, but it seems to me that what the world needs is human beings who are free, who are creative, who have no fear. And most of us are ridden with fear. If you can go profoundly into fear and really understand it, you will come out with innocence so that your mind is clear. That is what we need, and that is why it is very important to understand how to look at a fact. How to look at your fear. That is the whole problem. Not how to get rid of fear, not how to be courageous, not what to do about fear, but to be fully with the fact. You want to be fully, totally with the wave of pleasure, don't you? And you are. When you are in the moment of pleasure, there is no condemnation, no justification, no denial. There is no factor of time at the moment of experiencing pleasure. Physically, sensually, your whole being vibrates with it. Isn't that so? When you are in the moment of experiencing, there is no time, is there? When you are intensely angry, or when you are full of lust, there is no time. Time comes in, thought comes in, only after the moment of experiencing. And then you say, by Jove, how nice, or how terrible. If it was nice, you want more of it. If it was terrible, fearful, you want to avoid it. Therefore, you begin to explain, to justify, to condemn. And these are the factors of time which prevent you from looking at the fact. Now, have you ever faced fear? Please listen to the question carefully. Have you ever looked at fear? Or, in the moment of being aware of fear, are you already in a state of flight from the fact? I will go into it a little bit and you will see what I mean. We give a term to our various feelings, don't we? In saying, I am angry, we have given a term, a name, a label to a particular feeling. Now, please watch your own minds very clearly. When you have a feeling, you name that feeling. You call it anger, lust, love, pleasure, don't you? And this naming of the feeling is a process of intellection which prevents you from looking at the fact, that is, at the feeling. When you see a bird and say to yourself that it is a parrot or a pigeon or a crow, you are not looking at the bird. You have already ceased to look at the fact, because the word parrot or pigeon or crow has come between you and the fact. This is not some difficult intellectual feat, but a process of the mind that must be understood. If you would go into the problem of fear, or the problem of authority, or the problem of pleasure, or the problem of love, you must see that naming, giving a label, prevents you from looking at the fact. Do you understand? You see a flower, and you call it a rose, and the moment you have thus given it a name, your mind is distracted. You are not giving your full attention to the flower. So, naming, terming, verbalizing, symbolizing prevents total attention toward the fact. Now, can the mind, which is addicted to symbols and whose very nature it is to verbalize, stop verbalizing and look at the fact? Don't say, how am I to do it? But put the question to yourself, I have a feeling and I call it fear. By giving it a name, I have related it to the past. So memory, the word, the symbol, is preventing me from looking at the fact. Now, can the mind, which in its very thought process verbalizes, gives names, look at the fact without naming it? You have to find this out for yourselves. I cannot tell you. If I tell you and you do it, you will be following and you won't be free of fear. What matters is that you should be totally free of fear and not be half-dead human beings, corrupt, miserable people who are everlastingly afraid of their own shadow. To understand this problem of fear, you have to go into it most profoundly, because fear is not merely on the surface of the mind. Fear is not just being afraid of your neighbor or of losing a job. It is much deeper than that. And to understand it requires deep penetration. To penetrate deeply, you need a very sharp mind. And the mind is not made sharp by mere argumentation or avoidance. One has to go into the problem step by step. And that is why it is very important to comprehend this whole process of naming. When you name a whole group of people by calling them Muslims, or what you will, you have got rid of them. You don't have to look at them as individuals. So the name, the word, has prevented you from being a human being in relationship with other human beings. In the same way, when you name a feeling, you are not looking at the feeling. you are not totally with the fact. There are innumerable forms of escape from fear, but if you escape, run away, fear will follow you everlastingly. To be fundamentally free of fear, you must understand this process of naming and realize that the word is never the thing. The mind must be capable of separating the word from the feeling and must not let the word interfere with direct perception of the feeling, which is the fact. When you have gone so far, penetrated so deeply, you will discover there is buried in the unconscious, in the obscure recesses of the mind, a sense of complete loneliness, of isolation, which is the fundamental cause of fear. And again, if you avoid it, if you escape from it, saying it is too fearful, if you do not go into it without giving it a name, you will never go beyond it. The mind has to come face to face with the fact of complete inward loneliness and not allow itself to do anything about that fact. That extraordinary thing called loneliness is the very essence of the self, the me, with all its chicaneries, its cunningness, its substitutions, its web of words in which the mind is caught. Only when the mind is capable of going beyond that ultimate loneliness is there freedom, the absolute freedom from fear. And only then will you find out for yourself what is reality, that immeasurable energy which has no beginning and no end. As long as the mind spawns its own fears in terms of time, it is incapable of understanding that which is timeless. Loneliness. I do not know if you have ever been lonely, when you suddenly realize that you have no relationship with anybody. Not an intellectual realization, but a factual realization, a thing that is as concrete as this microphone, and you are completely isolated. Every form of thought and emotion is blocked. There is nobody to turn to. The gods, the angels, have all gone beyond the clouds, and as the clouds vanish, they have also vanished. You are completely lonely. I will not use the word alone. Alone has quite a different meaning. Alone has beauty. To be alone means something entirely different, and you must be alone. When man frees himself from the social structure of greed, envy, ambition, arrogance, achievement, status, when he frees himself from those, then he is completely alone. That is quite a different thing. Then there is great beauty, the feeling of great energy. But loneliness is not that. Loneliness is this complete sense of being isolated from everything. I do not know if you have felt it. The more you are awake, the more you are questioning, looking, asking, demanding, the more you are aware of it. Deep down in your consciousness, at all the levels, you feel completely cut off. And that is one of the great sorrows, not being able to go beyond it, and being caught in that tremendous feeling of loneliness with its great energy. It has got vitality, a drive, an insistence, an ugliness, and we escape from it in every form. Either we are terribly clever, write books about that loneliness, and push aside that loneliness, or we run away, amuse ourselves, and never touch it. And it remains there, hidden, but like a cancerous wound. It is there, waiting. One has to come into contact with it, not verbally, but actually. This loneliness is a form of death. There is dying not only when life comes to an end, but when there is no answer, there is no way out. That is also a form of death. Being in the prison of your own self-centered activity endlessly. When you are caught in your own thoughts, in your own agony, in your own superstitions, in your deadly daily routine of habit. And we will prolong it for another 50 years or more. The same self-centered, brutal activities. Ambition, competition, seeking status, position, power, greed, envy. We live in this pressure of families, of relationship with each other. There is the sexual pressure, the demand over each other, the possessive dependence, attachment, jealousy, anxiety, hatred, and so on. So why do human beings throughout the world live like this? Is it because they are lazy, indifferent, callous, that they talk about relationship and they don't mean a thing by that word? Is it habit? Is it tradition? Is it that we don't know how to break through this? And perhaps that may be one of the reasons why human beings do accept so easily to live in this conflict. What do we mean by the word relationship? To be related, to be in contact with. When you use the words in contact with, not only physically, sexually, but much more, psychologically, it implies that you are actually in contact psychologically with another. Is that so? Or are you in contact with the image that you have projected about her, the image that thought has created during a 30-year or 40-year relationship, intimate or not, or during a relationship that lasted for 10 days? You create an image about that person, and that image is projected by memory, by experience, by the knowledge that you have accumulated about her or him. That knowledge is stored in the brain, and that becomes memory. So you are looking at the woman or the man from the knowledge that you have acquired about her. You project that knowledge upon her, and you see the image that you have projected, and you think you are in contact with that person. But actually, you are only in contact with the image that thought has projected about her or him. I think most of us are aware, sometimes, perhaps only rarely, since most of us are so terribly active, that the mind is empty. And being aware, we are afraid of that emptiness. We have never inquired into that state of emptiness. We have never gone into it deeply, profoundly. We are afraid, and so we wander away from it. We have given it a name. We say it is empty. It is terrible. It is painful. And that very giving it a name has already created a reaction in the mind, a fear, an avoidance, a running away. Now, can the mind stop running away and not give it a name, not give it the significance of a word such as empty, about which we have memories of pleasure and pain? Can we look at it? Can the mind be aware of that emptiness without naming it, without running away from it, without judging it, but just be with it? Because then, that is the mind. Then, there is not an observer looking at it. There is no censor who condemns it. There is only that state of emptiness, with which we are all really quite familiar, but which we are all avoiding, trying to fill it with activity, with worship, with prayer, with knowledge, with every form of illusion and excitement. But when all the excitement, illusion, fear, running away stops, and you are no longer giving it a name, and thereby condemning it, is the observer different then from the thing which is observed? Surely, by giving it a name, By condemning it, the mind has created a censor, an observer, outside of itself. But when the mind does not give it a term, a name, condemn it, judge it, then there is no observer, only a state of that thing we have called emptiness. I wonder if we are conscious that we do depend psychologically on others. Not that it is necessary or justifiable or wrong, psychologically, to depend on others, but are we, first of all, aware that we are dependent? Most of us are psychologically dependent, not only on people, but on property, on beliefs, on dogmas. Are we at all conscious of that fact? If we know that we do depend on something for our psychological happiness, for our inward stability, security, then we can ask ourselves, why? Why do we psychologically depend on something? Obviously, because in ourselves we are insufficient, poor, empty. In ourselves we are extraordinarily lonely, and it is in this loneliness, this emptiness, this extreme inward poverty and self-enclosure that makes us depend on a person, on knowledge, on property, on opinion, and on so many other things which seem necessary to us. Now, can the mind be fully aware of the fact that it is lonely, insufficient, empty? It is very difficult to be aware, to be fully cognizant of that fact, because we are always trying to escape from it. And we do temporarily escape from it through listening to the radio and other forms of amusement, through going to church, performing rituals, acquiring knowledge, and through dependence on people and on ideas. To know your own emptiness, you must look at it. But you cannot look at it if your mind is all the time seeking a distraction from the fact that it is empty. And that distraction takes the form of attachment to a person, to the idea of God, to a particular dogma or belief, and so on. Can the mind stop running away, escaping, and not merely ask how to stop running away? Because the very inquiry into how the mind is to stop escaping becomes another escape. If I know that a certain path does not lead anywhere, I do not walk on that path. There is no question of how not to walk on it. Similarly, if I know that no escape, no amount of running away will ever resolve this loneliness, this inward emptiness, then I stop running. I stop being distracted. Then the mind can look at the fact that it is lonely, and there is no fear. It is in the very process of running away from what is that fear arises. When the mind understands the futility, the utter uselessness of trying to fill its own emptiness through dependence, through knowledge, through belief, then it is capable of looking at it without fear. And can the mind continue to look at that emptiness without any evaluation? When the mind is fully aware that it escapes, runs away from itself, when it realizes the futility of running away, and sees that the very process of running away creates fear, when it realizes the truth of that, then it can face what is. Now, what do we mean when we say that we are facing what is? Are we facing it, looking at it? If we are always giving a value to it, interpreting it, if we have opinions about it, surely opinions, values, interpretations, merely prevent the mind from looking at the fact. If you want to understand the fact, it is no good having an opinion about it. So, can we look without any evaluation at the fact of our psychological emptiness, our loneliness, which breeds so many other problems? I think that is where the difficulty lies, in our incapacity to look at ourselves without judgment, without condemnation, without comparison, because we have all been trained to compare, to judge, to evaluate, to give an opinion. Only when the mind sees the futility of all that, the absurdity of it, is it capable of looking at itself. Then that which we have feared as being lonely, empty, is no longer empty. Then there is no psychological dependence on anything. Then love is no longer attachment, but something entirely different, and relationship has quite another meaning. But to find that out for oneself, and not merely repeat it verbally, one must understand the process of escape. In the very understanding of escape, there is the stopping of escape, and the mind is able to look at itself. In looking at itself, there must be no evaluation, no judgment. Then the fact is important in itself, and there is complete attention, without any desire for distraction. Therefore, the mind is no longer empty. Complete attention is the good. I depend on my parents when I am young, and as I grow older, I depend on society, on a job, on capacity. And when these fail me, I depend upon faith. There is always a dependence, a faith in something. That dependence sustains me, gives me vitality, energy. And as with all dependencies, there is always fear, and so I set conflict going. Or, having no faith, I cultivate consistency, to be constant in my life, according to my idea, and that very consistency endangers my self-confidence. The more I am consistent, the less I am strong, vital, clear-cut. Self-consistency, to be consistent to a certain form, to a certain action, is what most of us are striving for, which is the cultivation of self-confidence. Wherever we try, there is always this desire to depend on something to give us strength, on a person, on a particular idea, on a political party, on a system, or on an experience. So there is always a dependence on something to sustain us. And as we depend more and more, there is the cultivation of fear. Dependence arises because in ourselves we are insufficient. In ourselves we are lonely. In ourselves we are empty. I depend, and therefore I cultivate faith. Therefore, we must have more knowledge. And as we become more and more civilized, more and more learned, materialistic or spiritual, we must have faith, or we turn cynics. For most of us, self-confidence is necessary. And for most of us, confidence is merely the continuation of an experience, or the continuation of knowledge. Does self-confidence ever free the mind from its own conditioning influence? Does this confidence, derived through effort, bring about freedom, or does it merely condition the mind? And is it not possible to free the mind, to remove all dependencies? That is, am I capable of being aware of my loneliness, of my complete emptiness, being aware of it without running away from it, and not being consistent through any particular form of knowledge or experience. That is our problem, is it not? Most of us are running away from ourselves as we are. We cultivate various forms of virtues to help us run away. We cultivate various forms of confidence, knowledge, experience. We depend on faith. But underneath it all, there is a sense of immense loneliness. And it is only when we are capable of looking at it, living with it, understanding it fully, that there is a possibility of acting without bringing about a series of efforts which condition the mind to a particular action. Please listen to this and you will see it. All our life, we try to be consistent to a particular thought or to a pattern of thought, and the very desire to be consistent creates energy, drive, gives us strength, and so narrows down the mind. The mind that is consistent is a very small mind, a petty mind. A small mind has enormous capacity for energy. It derives a great deal of strength from its pettiness. And so our life becomes very small, very limited, very narrow. Can we realize this process of dependence from which we derive strength, in which there is conflict, in which there is fear, envy, jealousy, competition, that constantly narrows down all our efforts so that there is always fear? Is it not possible to look, to be aware of our loneliness, of our emptiness, and to understand it without trying to escape from it? The very understanding of it is not to condemn it, but to be passively aware of it, to listen to the whole content of that loneliness. It means really to go beyond the self, beyond the me, and from there act, because our present action is within the confines of the me. It may be enlarged, extended, but it is always the me identifying with a person or an ideal. And that identification gives us a great deal of strength to act, to do, to be. And that identification strengthens the me, the I, the self, in which there is everlasting conflict, everlasting misery. And so all our actions lead to frustration. Recognizing that, we turn to faith, we turn to God as a source of strength. And that too is the enlargement of the me, the strengthening of the me, because the me is running away from itself, from that loneliness in itself. When we are capable of facing that loneliness without condemnation or judgment, looking at it, understanding it, hearing the whole content of the me, of that loneliness, then only is there a possibility of having strength which is not of the me. Then only is there a possibility of bringing about a different world or a different culture. Discontent. Have you ever wondered why it is that as people grow older, they seem to lose all joy in life, that joyous intimation of something beyond, something of greater significance? Why do so many of us, as we grow into so-called maturity, become dull, insensitive to joy, to beauty, to the open skies, and the marvelous earth? You know, when one asks oneself this question, many explanations spring up in the mind. We are so concerned with ourselves. That is one explanation. We struggle to become somebody, to achieve and maintain a certain position. We have children and other responsibilities, and we have to earn money. All these external things soon weigh us down, and thereby we lose the joy of living. Look at the older faces around you. See how sad most of them are, how careworn and rather ill, how withdrawn, aloof, and sometimes neurotic, without a smile. Don't you ask yourself why? And even when we do ask why, most of us seem to be satisfied with mere explanations. Yesterday evening, I saw a boat going up the river at full sail, driven by the west wind. It was a large boat, heavily laden with firewood for the town. The sun was setting, and this boat against it. There was no effort, for the wind was doing all the work. Similarly, if each one of us could understand the problem of struggle and conflict, then I think we would be able to live effortlessly, happily, with a smile on our face. I think it is effort that destroys us, this struggling in which we spend almost every moment of our lives. If you watch the older people around you, you will see that for most of them, life is a series of battles with themselves, with their wives or husbands, with their neighbors, with society, and this ceaseless strife dissipates energy. The man who is joyous, really happy, is not caught up in effort. To be without effort does not mean that you stagnate, that you are dull, stupid. On the contrary, it is only the wise, the extraordinarily intelligent, who are really free of effort, of struggle. But, you see, when we hear of effortlessness, we want to be like that. We want to achieve a state in which we will have no strife, no conflict. So we make that our goal, our ideal, and strive after it. And the moment we do this, we have lost the joy of living. We are again caught up in effort, struggle. The object of struggle varies, but all struggle is essentially the same. One may struggle to bring about social reforms, or to find God, or to create a better relationship between oneself and one's wife or husband, or with one's neighbor. One may sit on the banks of the Ganga, worship at the feet of some guru, and so on. All this is effort, struggle. So what is important is not the object of struggle, but to understand struggle itself. Now, is it possible for the mind to be not just casually aware that for the moment it is not struggling, but completely free of struggle all the time, so that it discovers a state of joy in which there is no sense of the superior and the inferior? Our difficulty is that the mind feels inferior, and that is why it struggles to be or become something, or to bridge over its various contradictory desires. But don't let us give explanations of why the mind is full of struggle. Every thinking man knows why there is struggle, both within and without. Our envy, greed, ambition, our competitiveness, leading to ruthless efficiency, these are obviously the factors which cause us to struggle, whether in this world or in the world to come. We don't have to study psychological books to know why we struggle. And what is important, surely, is to find out if the mind can be totally free of struggle. After all, when we struggle, the conflict is between what we are and what we should be or want to be. Now, without giving explanations, can one understand this whole process of struggle so that it comes to an end? Like that boat which was moving with the wind, can the mind be without struggle? Surely this is the question, and not how to achieve a state in which there is no struggle. The very effort to achieve such a state is itself a process of struggle. Therefore, that state is never achieved. But if you observe from moment to moment how the mind gets caught in everlasting struggle, if you just observe the fact without trying to alter it, without trying to force upon the mind a certain state which you call peace, then you will find that the mind spontaneously ceases to struggle. And in that state, it can learn enormously. Learning is then not merely the process of gathering information, but a discovery of the extraordinary riches that lie beyond the hope of the mind. And for the mind that makes this discovery, there is joy. Watch yourself, and you will see how you struggle from morning till night, and how your energy is wasted in this struggle. If you merely explain why you struggle, you get lost in explanations, and the struggle continues. Whereas, if you observe your mind very quietly, without giving explanations, if you just let the mind be aware of its own struggle, you will soon find that there comes a state in which there is no struggle at all, but an astonishing watchfulness. In that state of watchfulness, there is no sense of the superior and the inferior. There is no big man or little man. There is no guru. All those absurdities are gone because the mind is fully awake, and the mind that is fully awake is joyous. Discontent is the striving after the more, and contentment is the cessation of that struggle. But you cannot come to contentment without understanding the whole process of the more and why the mind demands it. We are struggling after something, and we have never paused to inquire if the thing we are after is worth struggling for. We have never asked ourselves if it's worth the effort, so we haven't yet discovered that it's not, and withstood the opinion of our parents, of society, of all the masters and gurus. It is only when we have understood the whole significance of the more that we cease to think in terms of failure and success. You see, we are so afraid to fail, to make mistakes. To make a mistake is considered terrible because we will be criticized for it. Somebody will scold us. But after all, why should you not make a mistake? Are not all the people in the world making mistakes? And would the world cease to be in this horrible mess if you were never to make a mistake? Imitation is a form of stealing. You are nothing, but he is somebody. So you are going to get some of his glory by copying him. This corruption runs right through human life, and very few are free of it. So what is important is to find out whether the inward emptiness can ever be filled. As long as the mind is seeking to fill itself, it will always be empty. When the mind is no longer concerned with filling its own emptiness, then only does that emptiness cease to be. The mind is everlastingly asking for more and more, and our whole civilization is based upon the acquiring of the more, the demand for more properties, more money, more, more, and more. Therefore, there is always comparison, therefore, everlastingly struggle. Knowing envy, we say we must cultivate non-envy, which is another form of the more, negatively. So is it possible for the mind not to think in terms of the more at all, not to compare, not to judge what it is? This is not stagnation. On the contrary, when the mind is not seeking the more, when it is not comparing, you are no longer concerned with time. Time implies the more. I will be something tomorrow. I will be happy in the future. I will be a rich man. I will fulfill. I will be loved. I shall love, and so on. The comparative mind, the mind that is asking for the more, is the mind of time, of tomorrow, is it not? So when such a mind says, I must not be envious, it is again another form of time, is it not? Another form of comparison is, I have been this, I shall be less than that. So can the mind, which is seeking the more, stop completely from the demand of the more, which is envy? Do you understand the problem, sirs? The problem is not how to be free from envy, which is a very small affair, but how not to think in terms of the more, how not to think comparatively, how not to think in terms of time, how not to think I will be. Can the mind ever not think in terms of the more? Do not say it is not possible. You do not know. All that you do know is the more knowledge, more influence, more clothes, more property, more love. If you cannot get the more, then you want the less and less and less. Now, is it possible for the mind not to think at all in those terms? First, put the question, do not help me to be free of envy. Can the mind cease to think in terms of the more? Put that question and listen, not only now, but when you go home, when you are taking the tram car, sitting in the bus, when you are walking alone, when you see a sorry, when you see a man going in a big car, the big politician, the big businessman. Put that question and find out and listen to it. Then you will find the truth of the matter. Then you will find that the truth frees the mind from the more. The mind then is not the conscious mind making an effort to denude itself of the more. When the mind makes a conscious effort of not asking for more, it is another form of negation of the same thing, of the more. So in that, there is no answer. But if you put that question, you can only listen to it when you are not judging, when you don't want a result, when you don't want to use it to produce a certain action. It is only when you are listening that it is possible for truth to come into being, which will free the mind from the more. We were walking in the open gardens near a huge hotel. There was a golden blue in the western sky, and the noise of the buses, cars, went by. There were young plants full of promise, watered daily. They were still building, creating the gardens, and a bird was hovering in the sky, fluttering its wings rapidly before it plunged to the earth. And in the east there was the nearing of the full moon. What was beautiful was none of these things, but the vast emptiness that seemed to hold the earth. What was beautiful was the poor man with his head down, carrying a small bottle of oil. Krishnamurti, what does sorrow mean in this country? How do the people in this country meet sorrow? Do they escape from sorrow through the explanation of karma? How does the mind in India operate when it meets sorrow? The Buddhist meets it in one way, the Christian in another way. How does the Hindu mind meet it? Does it resist sorrow or escape from it? Or does the Hindu mind rationalize it? Pupul Jayakar. Are there really many ways of meeting sorrow? Sorrow is pain, the pain of someone dying, the pain of separation. Is it possible to meet this pain in various ways? K. There are various ways of escape, but there is only one way of meeting sorrow. The escapes with which we are all familiar are really the ways of avoiding the greatness of sorrow. You see, we use explanations to meet sorrow, but these explanations do not answer the question. The only way to meet sorrow is to be without any resistance, to be without any movement away from sorrow, outwardly or inwardly, to remain totally with sorrow, without wanting to go beyond it. P.J. What is the nature of sorrow? K. There is personal sorrow, the sorrow that comes with the loss of someone you love, the loneliness, the separation, the anxiety for the other. With death, there is also the feeling that the other has ceased to be, and there was so much that he wanted to do. All this is personal sorrow. Then there is that man, ill-clad, dirty, with his head down. He is ignorant. Ignorant not merely of book knowledge, but deeply, really ignorant. The feeling that one has for the man is not self-pity, nor is there an identification with that man. It is not that you are placed in a better position than he is, and so you feel pity for him. But there is within one the sense of the timeless weight of sorrow in man. This sorrow has nothing personal about it. It exists. P.J. While you have been speaking, the movement of sorrow has been operating within me. There is no immediate cause for this sorrow, but it seems like a shadow always with man. He lives, he loves, he forms attachments, and everything ends. Whatever the truth of what you say, in this there is such an infinitude of sorrow. How is it to end? There appears to be no answer. The other day you said that in sorrow is the whole movement of passion. What does it mean? K. Is there a relationship between sorrow and passion? I wonder what sorrow is. Is there such a thing as sorrow without cause? We know the sorrow which is cause and effect. My son dies. In that is involved my identification with my son, my wanting him to be something which I am not, my seeking continuity through him. And when he dies, all that is denied, and I find myself completely emptied of all hope. In that there is self-pity, fear. In that there is pain, which is the cause of sorrow. This is the lot of everyone. This is what we mean by sorrow. Then also there is the sorrow of time, the sorrow of ignorance, not the ignorance of knowledge, but the ignorance of one's own destructive conditioning, the sorrow of not knowing oneself, the sorrow of not knowing the beauty that lies at the depth of one's being and the going beyond. Do we see that when we escape from sorrow through various forms of explanation, we are really frittering away an extraordinary happening? P.J. Then what does one do? K. You have not answered my question. Is there a sorrow without cause and effect? We know sorrow and the movement away from sorrow. Man has lived with sorrow from immemorial times. He has never known how to deal with it. So he has either worshipped it or run away from it. They are both the same movement. My mind does not do either, nor does it use sorrow as a means of awakening. Then, what takes place? P.J. All other things are the products of our senses. Sorrow is more than that. It is a movement of the heart. K. I am asking you, what is the relationship between sorrow and love? PJ. Both are movements of the heart. The one is identified as joy, and the other as pain. K. Is love pleasure? Would you say joy and pleasure are the same? Without understanding the nature of pleasure, there is no depth to joy. You cannot invite joy. Joy happens. The happening can be turned into pleasure. When that pleasure is denied, there is the beginning of sorrow. Pleasure I can invite. Pleasure I can pursue. If pleasure is love, then love can be cultivated. PJ. We know pleasure is not love. Pleasure may be one manifestation of love, but it is not love. Both sorrow and love emerge from the same source. K. I asked, what is the relationship between sorrow and love? Can there be love if there is sorrow? Sorrow being all the things that we have talked about. In sorrow, there is a factor of separation, of fragmentation. Is there not a great deal of self-pity in sorrow? What is the relationship of all this to love? Has love dependency? Has love the quality of the me and the you? When there is no movement of escape from sorrow, then love is. Passion is the flame of sorrow, and that flame can only be awakened when there is no escape, no resistance. Which means what? Which means sorrow has in it no quality of division. What is relationship for a mind which has understood sorrow and therefore the ending of sorrow? What is the quality of the mind that is no longer afraid of ending, which is death? When energy is not dissipated through escape, then that energy becomes the flame of passion. Compassion means passion for all. Compassion is passion for all.